achieving its more or less settled form by the late 12th century. It was perhaps the preeminent case of the church's responsiveness to pastoral and practical necessities. Most dying humans were too fallible to deserve immediate entry to heaven, an honor traditionally reserved for ascetic saints and heroic martyrs. Yet it was hard to believe that a loving God, who wanted to redeem humanity, would wish the great mass of the morally mediocre to suffer for eternity in hell. Purgatory supplied a logically satisfying method of admitting such people to heaven. The atonement removed the collective barrier to salvation. Baptism washed away the individual impediment of original sin, and God's absolution, delivered via the priest in the sacrament of penance, forgave any further disqualifying, mortal sins it was human habit to commit. But legally minded medieval theologians drew a distinction between the guilt attached to a sin and a penalty or satisfaction still due to God for it when the guilt was removed. Penances imposed by priests in confession made a start with this, but most people would end their lives with a great deal of satisfaction still due. Purgatory was where the debt would finally be paid. The existence of purgatory was formally defined by church councils in 1274 and 1439, but official formulations were remarkably vague about what sort of place it was and what departed souls could expect to experience there. The vacuum was filled by preachers and authors of devotional books who described a place of intense, fiery torment. A place indeed hardly distinguishable from hell, and often imagined as situated next to it under the earth. Time, in the next life, was a mysterious, almost metaphorical concept. But most Christians, clergy as well as lay folk, expected tariffs due in the prison of purgatory to be measurable in tens, hundreds, or thousands of years. To anyone facing the prospect of death, it was imperative to consider how that sentence might be reduced. This entailed considerable degrees of diversity and choice. Men and women hoping to reduce time in purgatory were supplicants for mercy, but they were also active consumers, contemplating a range of competing offers of assistance. One expedient was purchase of an indulgence. These seemed to offer a great deal, in both senses of the phrase. Indulgences were certificates, remitting part or all of the satisfaction due for sins, expressed in terms of days and years. They were a logical, even ingenious conclusion from an attractive premise. All Christians, living and dead, on earth, in purgatory, and in heaven, formed part of a single church, what the Apostles' Creed called the Communion of Saints. Some members of the communion passed into heaven with a superabundance of merit, more satisfaction than they personally needed. This was preeminently true of Christ himself, but also of great saints and martyrs down the ages. Their surplus of satisfaction was available for redistribution to less holy members of the communion of saints from a treasury of merit administered by the church. Only the Pope could offer a plenary indulgence, removing all punishment due for sins, a claim grounded in Christ's